Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, inflation falls, wages are up, mortgage rates continue to move south, albeit slowly, fixed savings accounts are peaking at 6%, and we aren't in recession. Can we see the oasis in the distance, or is it all a mirage? Also today, Rishi vows to keep the triple lock for now, but can we afford it? Forget political views, banks are now closing accounts for being too charitable, says one reader, and need to fix your own furniture? Pass the toothpaste. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news, just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, crack open the champers, everybody. Inflation is falling. The 2% light is at the end of the cost of living crisis tunnel, which means the Bank of England is obviously going to stop with the pesky rate hikes. Mortgages are going to fall and we can all go home. Thank you. Right? Simon, welcome. Inflation. What's the latest? Why is it falling? What's down? What's up? Can we all go home?
Well, inflation figures, not too bad, not too shabby, okay? 6.8%. I mean, under any normal circumstances, you would consider that pretty shabby. But the fact that this is inflation that had been above 10% not so long ago makes this look pretty good and like something to celebrate. It was actually pretty much bang on the forecasts. So it was in line with expectations. That means that there wasn't any nasty stuff in there to make markets freak out. But if you look below the headline figure, what you'll find is that core inflation, this disturbing underlying number that strips out volatile energy and food prices and also alcohol and tobacco, because those are largely taxed, remains stubbornly high. It's stuck at 6.9%. It was also at 6.9% the month before. Again, not bad enough to make people freak out like the core inflation number back in May did, when everybody went, whoa, that was just pretty much the start of the kind of mortgage panic stations scenario. But it was enough to make people think that the Bank of England isn't going to be stopping raising interest rates anytime soon, and that it will have to deliver another probably quarter point rise in September, and then maybe another two beyond that. Markets are now saying base rate going to peak at just under 6%, so probably 6% if you kind of round up, whereas they were thinking before maybe 5.5% to 5.75%. But there's a real margin of error in that. You can't read too much into market expectations of interest rates of exactly where the peak is going to be or where it's going to be. And I would file that still in the no need to freak out box. What has rattled markets slightly and has led to gilt yields climbing is the expectation, not necessarily that rates will rise much further than was previously thought, but that they will stay higher for longer. And that's the disturbing thing, particularly for any mortgaged homeowners who have been watching the chaos unfurl in the very much unwanted Mortgage Mayhem 2 episode that nobody was looking for a second series of after the Liz Truss original series. And they were hoping it would go away. And we'd go, right, okay, hit peak. Now inflation's come down, we start lowering rates. And that they would then either face mortgage costs that were nowhere near as high when they came to remortgage, or if they have just remortgaged and gone for a two-year fix because they don't want to be paying those rates for 5 years, then in 2 years' time, rates would be considerably lower than they are now. Markets say, maybe not, actually probably going to stay high for longer than you think. But again, you really can't read too much into that, to be honest, because market forecasts are regularly wrong. And I was looking at an article that we wrote in April, When Will Interest Rates Fall? Ed Magnus picked up, did a really good job on that. And the expectations of what we're going to have to interest rates in April were totally different to what they are now. Now, obviously, we had that inflation-driven freak out mortgage market chaos in the middle. But things can change quickly. And just like that changed very quickly, it could change back very quickly as well. I mean, overall, the message is we're heading in the right direction. The real question, though, from a lot of economists and analysts is, okay, so inflation falls back down to a normal level. Maybe it gets down to the 2% target. But do we then just get another spike soon after that? That's the disturbing thing, is that actually we're not going to go back to a world of low and stable inflation. We might go to a world where we see regular inflation spikes.
Why would that be the case?
Because of a lot of that low and stable inflation through the 2000s was the product of a particular moment in time. You had globalization, you know, bringing down prices, cheap goods flooding in from China and things like that. You had very low wage pressure and all that kind of stuff. And now the world is a different place, where America and China are constantly rattling each other's cages. Russia's invaded Ukraine. A lot of companies are looking at doing reshoring, making sure that their supply chains are shorter post-COVID and post all these shocks, which means that things are becoming more expensive. So rather than just finding the cheapest place in the world to do something, they're going, okay, well, it's more expensive to do it here, but we're going to do it here because otherwise that's an existential threat to our business. And also because Joe Biden has been splashing the cash like nobody's business on the ironically entitled Inflation Reduction Act in the US, which involves a colossal amount of green spending in order to try to make the US more energy sufficient with a lot of kind of renewable energy stuff and everything like that. And all of that money is quite inflationary. And that's one of the reasons why the US economy is running so hot at the moment as well. So there's a lot of different things going on there that mean that the next 10, 20 years might not look like the last 10, 20 years did. And also you've got to factor in, of course, the financial crisis and rates being kept on the floor and the worries about deflation in the wake of that. So, yeah.
You mentioned there, Simon, about an article that you read about when will interest rates go down in April. I remember writing an article about whether we'll get negative rates. Seems a long, long time ago that I wrote that one, and it wasn't. So, Helen, not the end of the cost of living crisis, but look, we have seen mortgage rates edge down a little bit. But still, as Simon said, it is sort of high mortgage rates part two. They're only a two-year fix, as I think something like 0.15%. below the peak that it hit after the Kwasi Kwarteng Liz Truss disaster, I'm going to call it today, debacle. Helen?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, when you talk about writing articles a while back. I remember not so long ago writing things like, oh no, our mortgage rate's going to go above 3%. Completely different world. I mean, on the mortgage front, we have seen some cuts from lenders the last couple of weeks. Some of them have even done double cuts. So I think Halifax has cut them twice in 2 weeks, Santander as well. So they are coming down. I think the thing we need to watch now is where the base rate goes next. Seems in all likelihood that's going to go up again. When that happens, generally, banks put their rates up again. But we don't know. I mean, we are kind of hearing that maybe we're starting to come to the end of the base rate hiking cycle, maybe towards the end of this year, early next year. So, you know, there is kind of a glimmer of hope on the horizon. But I think if anyone's expecting that stuff like, you know, mortgage rates and the cost of living is going to go back to being as cheap as it was a couple of years ago, that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Simon, I've asked on this podcast before, is lingering high inflation so bad in comparison to what we're seeing for mortgages and borrowers at the moment with rate rises? You know, is the cure actually causing more pain, or could cause more pain? That's one of the arguments that we're hearing, is it takes about 18 months to 2 years for us to feel the economy, to feel the full effects of rate rises. And so they only started rising about 18 months ago. So in theory, we should only really in the next sort of couple of months be seeing the first rate rise. Is the Bank of England, as sort of I've heard some economists arguing, pushing us needlessly into recession if they continue with this without pausing to see what the effect could be?
Yeah, there's a strong case for the argument that the Bank of England is needlessly pushing us into recession. It might not even push us into recession, to be honest. I mean, I'm surprised we're not there already, but, you know, it might be that the economy is resilient enough. And you have to remember, of course, that there's quite a lot of people who don't have mortgages, and quite a lot of those people who don't have mortgages have a reasonable amount of money, and they can support the economy. I mean, in those inflation figures, the things that brought inflation down was the energy price cap being reduced to £2,074, which is substantially lower than the previous energy price guarantee of £2,500. Food inflation also eased and managed to help bring the overall inflation number down, despite the fact that food inflation is still running at 14.9%. But what pushed it up was airfares and hotels, people spending money on going on holiday. Now, if you align those two things with the horror stories you read about how people's mortgages are going up by £500 a month, and where am I going to find £500 a month or £1,000 a month or whatever, and then everybody spending so much money on holidays and hotels that is driving up the inflation numbers, it's quite difficult to square those two things. But economies are quite complex. And we've seen this in the past where, you know, even in the wake of the financial crisis, I remember, you know, financial crisis was pretty bad. People were worrying about banks going under on a daily basis. It went out in the centre of London. The restaurants were full. The pubs were full. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, even, you know, now when we talk about recession and things like that, it's like, really? People are struggling? Cost of living crisis? Because I see a lot of people spending a lot of money. But people will choose where they spend the money. And in aggregate, it's the how it hits. And in aggregate, this is taking a lot of money out of the economy and giving it to banks who get to charge higher mortgage rates. But the hit to those people who are facing this is substantial. We talked about this on the podcast last week. Helen wrote the article about, is your mortgage hike going to swallow your pay rise? And then some, you know, basically for most people. And for a lot of people, it is. And those are the people who tend to be younger. They have the bigger mortgage payments anyway. They might have young families or older families or kids. It disproportionately hits the under 50s, let's say. So you probably don't have that many people in their early 20s who own a home. You get towards the end of the early, you know, even now the late 20s, most people don't own a home. So it's probably disproportionately hitting a section of society aged between 30 and 50. The rest of them aren't feeling it as bad, but rents are going up like nobody's business and causing people problems. But again, it's quite lumpy. Your rent stays the same until you have to move, and then you get whacked. The same with the mortgage. Your mortgage stays the same until your fix ends, and then you get whacked. So there are parts of society, you know, unmortgaged homeowners who aren't getting whacked. And quite a lot of them have, you know, generally speaking, quite a lot of money and quite a lot of disposable income. Maybe they're enough to keep it afloat. But even if we don't go into a recession, it doesn't mean that the impact isn't quite heavy. And yeah, I do think there's a very strong argument that rates have gone up so quickly in such a short space of time. The Bank of England isn't really allowing the effects to filter through. But what the Bank of England is trying to do, as we've said before, is it can't do anything about the inflation that we've seen already. That 6.8%, you know, I mean, a lot of it's still hanging over us from food inflation, energy price inflation, all that kind of stuff. You know, that was the big double digit numbers that we've seen. Sorry. You know, it can't do anything about that. What it wants to do is try and crush inflation in the future. And if that means crushing people's hopes and expectations, you know, in the way that they're doing to many people, then they've made it clear they're happy to do that. And you have to remember that central bankers aren't, they're only human. They might seem like strange aliens who have 500 grand a year salaries and then lecture us about not asking for a pay rise when our bills are going up, but they are only human. And like most humans, they suffer from the same human behavioral traits, and they will follow the path of least resistance. And for many years, the path of least resistance was just leaving rates on hold. Even when people were going, need to raise rates, need to raise rates, need to raise rates. Yeah, economy's fine. Don't need rates at 0.5%. Don't need rates at 0.1%. They just sat there on their hands. No, can't raise rates. That might be terrible. And then all of a sudden they got shocked into acting. And now they just can't stop raising rates. And the path of least resistance is to just keep going. I mean, they will obviously reach a point at which they stop, hopefully. But yeah, they're just doing that. So for now, you know, the MPC is going to make a decision in September, and it's probably going to go, well, if we stop now, people might say we haven't done the job yet, and we're going too easy on inflation, and we've already had a kicking for that in the last couple of years. So what's another quarter point? Let's put them up another quarter point. And they'll probably keep doing that. So, you know, it's a tricky situation. The only thing I would say is that we are in a scenario where we're talking about this, but rates aren't even really by historic standards that high. They're probably only roughly where they actually should be. And so there's this question of, do we go back to the old fashioned situation where interest rates are slightly higher than inflation, but also hopefully where pay rises are higher than inflation as well. And that's where we want to get back to. The scenario where people got a real increase in their wages and also that interest rates were above inflation, so they could be used properly as a tool to keep inflation down, rather than the totally mad world that we existed in post-financial crisis.
Which leads us beautifully onto wage growth figures and away from the Bank of England dream destroyer that it is. I really hope they don't sit around, by the way, when they're deciding what to do with rates and go, ooh, people might think that. I hope they just look at the detail and the economics and make a really sensible decision, because while they are people, Simon, they are responsible for the lives of about 70 million people. So anyway, Helen, before I go off.
I mean, I must admit, to any members of the MPC listening, I'm sorry if I very unfairly characterised what you might be doing. I know that you don't really do that.
No, and I'm pretty confident they are avid listeners, Simon. Helen, you wrote an article recently about, will mortgage rate rises erode your pay rise? We got wage growth figures this week showing that actually it is above inflation. Good news for us, maybe bad news for the Bank of England, because that's the one thing that they are, one of the things that they're deeply concerned about. A bit like the inflation figures, though, we need to dig a little bit deeper into the causes of the rise. Tell us more.
Yeah, so this is legitimately some quite good news on the face of it. You have to be a bit careful about comparing the figures because they do relate to slightly different time periods. But this week, average wage growth, this for April to June, was 7.8%, and inflation obviously 6.8%. So it's gone above, which is good news for the money in people's pockets. So to give an example, that means that someone was earning £20,000 a year, that's about £1,666 a month before tax. They would see their pre-tax pay rise by about £130 a month on average. Not bad. As you said, that could still well be eaten away if you're someone who has seen their mortgage rate go up massively. But in general, you know, more money in people's pockets, good thing. However, there do sort of come into play some wider concerns from a sort of economic point of view. Basically, we don't want to end up in a situation where businesses keep putting up people's wages to cope with the higher cost of living, and then the cost of things continues going up and inflation basically never goes away because people keep earning more, then stuff costs more, then people earn more again, and it just turns into what people call a kind of a wage spiral. Generally, I think it is good news for people. Something else that's interesting, though, when you dig into the figures, wage rises are quite different depending on what kind of job you're in and also how much you earn. So these figures, public sector workers, their wages went up quite a lot, 14%, but that's because they got this one-off cost of living payment of £1,500. So they are civil servants doing pretty well. People in the accommodation and food service activities sector, though, people who work for kind of hotels, restaurants, things like that, they're some of the lowest paid people, and they also have the lowest increase in their wages, so only 5.6%. So the picture is quite different depending on what kind of industry you work in. Also, looks like higher earners are kind of doing the best in terms of wage rises, which isn't necessarily a good look for them. So since June 2021, Britain's highest earners, that's those in the 99th percentile of wealthiest people, they've seen their average monthly pay go up from £13,391 a month to £15,081 a month. That's an increase of 12.6% in a couple of years. Meanwhile, people in the lowest percentile of earners have only seen their wage go up by 10%. So yeah, it's a different picture for different people, but broadly, some good news.
Yeah, that's right. It's I think I heard someone call it a tale of three economies, with high inflation, food prices and energy really hitting the poorest. Then you've got mortgages, of course, hitting those in the middle who are using their savings up. And then you have some people that, well, actually, all right, Jack. One group, though, that would be very happy if wage growth sticks at over 8% is pensioners. After a bumper 10.1% rise this April, the state pension could be in line for another big increase next year. Rishi Sunak's already stated that the triple lock will stay. But can we afford it? Simon, 101, what's the triple lock? And how much would it cost if it went up with wages, as they are now, obviously?
The triple lock is a measure put in place to make sure that people don't get pension rises of like pennies. After many years of very low pension rises that led to headlines such as, you know, people get an extra pound a week, this was put in place to make sure that there was always a reasonable rise in the pension. And what it means is that the state pension goes up by one of three things. So either average wages, inflation, or 2.5%. That's the baseline. So it would always go up by at least 2.5%. And actually, for many years, this wasn't that expensive a policy for the government to enact. Since the pandemic, it's caused them a real headache, though. Firstly, post-pandemic, wage figures went nuts and average showed massive growth in average wages. But that was to do with people coming back off furlough, coming back into the economy. People weren't actually getting those pay rises. So that was the first problem. Then you had the inflation problem. So we had the big 10.1% rise. But then, you know, to be fair, actually, it gets described as a bumper rise. But all it did was make sure that people didn't get poorer. So it rose in line, you know, with inflation. And it's not pensioners' fault that inflation was so high. You know, you can't hold them responsible for it. So maybe it's only fair enough. And actually, what's interesting about this is that we're all obviously paying for it. There is a misconception that people paid their national insurance in through their working lives, and that means that goes to pay their pension in retirement. That's not how it works. They pay their national insurance in during their working lives, and they're paying for the people in retirement at the point when they're working. So the people who are paying for pensioners now are the people who are working now. But it's not all bad news for those people, because if the state pension goes up by 10% now, or potentially goes up by 8.2% in September, well, that obviously bumps up the state pension and means that in years to come, when we hopefully get the state pension, our state pension will be higher as well. And actually, the effect of compounding over the years means that it does those of us who are still working and paying for the pension a bit of a favour for it to go up. There is also the accusation that the pension in the UK is among the meanest in the Western world, and that we don't really pay that much in state pension. But those figures are slightly skewed, or quite heavily skewed, by the fact that quite a lot of the countries, when the comparison is done, actually incorporate a large part of their workplace pensions into their state pension. So, for example, in France is a totally different system to here, and you cannot compare the state pension in the UK to the state pension in France, because you also have to factor in that obviously we have a large workplace pension scheme and people are also enrolled into it now as well, and it's actually, you need to add those two things together. But the UK pension isn't super generous, just to be clear, but it's not quite as bad as it looks. So yeah, it looks like it's going to go up because wages are running hot and wages are now above inflation. Inflation is forecast to potentially dip again next month, the next reading that will be taken, because it's the next reading that counts for this. And wages are running at 8.2%, including bonuses, and wages is likely to be the number that is used.
I mean, Helen, it is great news for when we eventually retire if it keeps going up like this. But the reality is it's looking really, really expensive. Government already saying that we're going to raise the state pension age. We'll just keep raising it and raising it and raising it until we don't take it anymore. I mean, this is expensive, isn't it?
It's incredibly expensive. So in our article, Steve Webb, former pensions minister, writes a pension column for us. He said if the state pension did go up with wages next year, an extra £2 billion bill arising from higher than expected earnings growth seems quite plausible. it's hugely costly, but I think the issue at the moment is that there is no way the government is going to scrap this. They've got an election coming up. It's extremely popular. The triple lock is wildly popular. So we did a poll in a recent article. We asked people, should the state pension triple lock pledge be kept, even if it costs taxpayers $2 billion more than anticipated? 94% of people said yes. 5% of people said no. And 1% of people said they should use another measure. It's wildly popular, and it's wildly popular with people who actually get out and vote. So there is, in short, no chance of this changing anytime soon.
We're not politicians, so we can say what we really think. Simon, should it be scrapped?
Quite ambivalent, to be honest. Costs an awful lot of money, but then we do want pensions to at least keep pace with inflation. So do you want to remove that bit, where they wouldn't keep pace with inflation? Then the 2.5% was put in because you kept finding this scenario where inflation, when inflation was low, people were getting almost no rise. Maybe that was the wrong thing to do, because to guarantee that, you know, even because remember, inflation at one point was knocking around the 0.5% level for quite a long time. Or alternatively, do you remove the wages element? I don't know. Maybe that would be the best element to remove. So maybe if we were staring down the barrel of a double lock, where it was you were either going to get inflation or you were going to get your 2.5% baseline, that would be a fairer measure. I do know that you can't, I would argue, get rid of it now before the next election, because the government promised to keep it, and you shouldn't welch on your promises. Like, you shouldn't welch on your bets, you know. So, I mean, they made a bet, and they got the bet totally wrong. I can't see Keir Starmer coming out campaigning for removing the triple lock. So, yeah.
Can't we just be, though,
but I do think maybe they
nuanced about it. Can't we just say, do you know what, let's wait every year and go, how are things looking in the wider economy? Not just have this kind of basic 1, 2, or 3. I appreciate triple lock does sound quite snazzy, but it's also a little bit restrictive. It's like the targets are not particularly helpful. No?
No, I agree with you. I mean, it's not. It's not. It's not a particularly helpful thing to have, but
we have it.
But it is good to know what metric is going to be used, rather than, it's very risky having a, well, we'll just make it up as the situation suits us policy. Those policies, we've got quite a few of those, it seems, or let's just tear up the policy when it doesn't suit us. And so it is good to have that, but it is also, as you said, good to not have something that binds you so tightly that you caused yourself a major problem.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North from eToro for our weekly look at what's been happening on the markets. Sam, how has the past week been?
An interesting one, for sure. We're set to finish the week with the third decline in a row for US equity markets. A mixture of a few things have added to this. We've got 15-year high US bond yields. We've got $85 oil prices, which is weighing on inflation worries. We've also got dramas in China with debt and growth worries, and also a few technical breaks to the S&P 500 below the 50-day moving average. This is all just adding to a bit of profit taking as well. So 3 down weeks in a row. Elsewhere this week, we saw the UK with probably a one-off inflation fall, but look, we can take that as a bit of a victory for now. Moody's cut US bank ratings. Walmart did beat expectations. That remains at all-time high for the share price. And Berkshire Hathaway made a pretty sizable bet on home builders. An interesting week all in all, I have to say. Still not enough for me to be overly worried as a long-term investor. But it is also worth noting that September is typically the worst month of the year for the stock market, seasonally wise. And of course, that's just around the corner.
And what do we have coming up next week? Is it a quiet holiday week, or do we have quite a bit of stuff on the cards?
Hopefully. I mean, it's the last full week of August, so you could be forgiven for thinking it'd be a quiet one. But things do feel like they're just starting to spice up again, especially with the China news. Scheduled wise, we've got the Fed and other global central banks at Jackson Hole, which is always worth tuning in to see if they make any comments on monetary policy. this time last year marked the short-term top in US equities as Jerome Powell spoke quite hawkishly. Will he do the same again? We'll have to wait and see. On Wednesday, we've also got Nvidia's quarterly earnings. Last quarter, that really propped up the market. So there'll be a lot of people hoping it will do the same thing. Also reporting BHP, Baidu and Zoom, worth keeping an eye on for sure. PMI data on Wednesday. And then we also have the first Republican primary debate on Wednesday too. So worth, again, sort of tuning into that to see how that develops. All in all, I'd say there's enough to keep us busy as we get to the back end of the month.
Well, we'll catch up this time next week and hopefully you'll be telling us about how it was a good week on the markets and they went up instead of down.
Yes, fingers crossed.
Thanks very much, Sam.
Cheers, Sam.
Welcome back. Crane is back on the case, and this time it's more bank account closures. But this time, however, it's for being too charitable. Helen?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one. Obviously, we've heard a lot in the last few weeks about debanking. Nigel Farage is the face of debanking. Everyone's talking about it. So I've had quite a lot of people get in touch with me and say, I've been debanked as well. I will say a lot of them for much more kind of probably interesting reasons than Nigel Farage, including this poor man who emailed me a couple of weeks ago and he said Nationwide have frozen my bank account. So they didn't actually close it, but they put a complete block on his debit card, couldn't make any payments online, couldn't get any cash out. So he was absolutely stuck. He literally said it happened one day when he was at work. He works quite a way away from where he lives. He was like, I had to borrow cash from one of my colleagues to get home from work. Like, it's mad how these things can just happen. No explanation. They're just like, yeah, your card's blocked. We're closing your account. And they don't like to really often explain why it's happened. So the banks would say that it's a fraud protection. So they don't want to tell people why they're freezing bank accounts, because banks say that would make it easier for people to get around the rules and basically defraud them. But it's obviously immensely frustrating if you're a person who's had their bank account frozen or closed. And this man, he was running out of food because he literally didn't have access to any of his money. And his account was Nationwide. So I got in touch with him and tried to say, what's going on? Can he get any money? He wanted to go to a branch and just see if they would give him like 20 quid to just buy some food. But they were like, no, like, can't be done, account frozen. So when I spoke to them, it turned out there was a really interesting reason for this. So he thought it might have been because he'd recently received inheritance, you know, a big unexpected sum going into his bank account. That's quite a common reason why this kind of thing might happen. But no, it turned out it was because he'd been doing too much charity work. So this man is a volunteer for the Trussell Trust, the food bank charity in his local area in Scotland. And as part of that, he does online orders for food with his local Sainsbury's. And then the arrangement they have is that they refund him the money. So in the space of a couple of months, he'd made 80, 40, 50, 60 pounds transactions with his local Sainsbury's, and they'd all been refunded back. And that is what Nationwide had flagged as the issue on his account, because everything was being refunded. And sometimes the amounts were a bit different between what he'd paid and what they refunded, just because of the kind of arrangement that he has with them for sort of costs, and they donate a bit of money to the charity as well. That, it turned out, was what resulted in his account being closed. They did reopen it when I got in touch, and they gave him £50 of compensation, which I felt wasn't really that generous, but it is back up and running now. But yeah, why, you know, you just don't expect these kind of reasons that something would be closed. And it shows, like, it could be almost anything. I mean, you have no idea. And I'm sure, if he'd been aware that that might be an issue, he could have just called them and said, oh, just so you know, I'm getting a lot of refunds because I do this. And if that might be suspicious, then here's some proof of what I'm doing. And it would never have happened. I think it's a tricky one, because it would be great if banks could be more open about the rules so people could, you know, flag things to them. But then obviously they don't want people knowing how to essentially scam them. So it's a tricky one. But there's loads of debanking at the minute, and people are really mad about it because it's really annoying not to have any of your own money.
annoying. It's in this day and age, it's almost impossible to get around and live a normal life. It's extraordinary. But in my Georgie utopian world, where people sensibly make decisions and that sort of thing, why did no one call him and say, like, you know, scams or something? You know, you get a message going, did you make this thing on your account? Why can't they say, is this right? Did you mean to go to Sainsbury's this often? I mean, I've not heard of money laundering through Sainsbury's, but you never know. Or is that part of the rules that say that they're giving him a tip off, presumably?
He didn't get any of those alerts when he was making the transactions. And I think that's because you often get those when you're making a transfer to like an individual rather than obviously a well-known company like Sainsbury's. And I think also the issue was the volume of transactions. So, you know, one purchase and refund wouldn't be flagged because that's not necessarily suspicious, but it was a volume of them. And I think that's something that these automated fraud systems can't necessarily track. But I think that, you know, it clearly could have been sorted quite a lot sooner than it was. He called them obviously straight away when it happened, and they said he had to wait 7 days to speak to someone in the fraud team to give them time to investigate. I mean, that's just far too long. Like you said, you can't live without a bank account in this day and age. It's a basic essential. And I just think the banks need to sort it out because it should be able to be done in hours.
Does that show the volume of cases that they're having to deal with, or is it just protocol? That's what, you know, the chain of command. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean,
because it could surely be done within a day.
Yeah, probably both. I mean, perhaps there is something in. It definitely seems like there's an increase in debanking at the moment. I think, you know, part of it is we're hearing more about it because Nigel Farage is out there campaigning about it. But I do think, you know, people who write to me, I have noticed an increase in it. And it's difficult to know what's behind that. Some people will say, oh, you know, banks are kind of trying to shed some of their customers, like kind of riskier customers. And that, you know, there's kind of a theory that maybe there's something not very kind of benign behind it. I don't know if that's true. But it seems like it's definitely on the increase. And, you know, maybe just the increase in scams as well. They're on kind of high alert for this kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, it should be quicker to sort out. And if people are having to wait a week, just hire more staff. Like obviously they need time to investigate it, but it can't take a week to get access to your debit card back. I will say this is probably a cautionary tale in have a second current account or have a credit card that you can use in emergencies. Obviously there's an argument this person shouldn't have to do that, you know, this was an error on Nationwide's part, but it does make your life easier if you have a second.
Good tip. Right, finally, I swear the next feature is a godsend for me. So I moved into my flat, rented flat, furnished, 10 months ago now. And about 9 months and 20 something days ago, i.e. a couple of days in, I was putting my TV up that I had so proudly put together, but put the wrong screws in. So I actually noticed there was a screw at the bottom that when I pushed the telly on the, this is not my cabinet, it made the most almighty scratch. And this does not look like a cheap cabinet. So I've been stressing ever since about, I mean, not loads about it, don't get me wrong, but a little bit about how on earth am I going to fix it? And do you remember that Yellow Pages advert where it's like, they all go out. Yes, Simon's nodding sagely there. They all go out. They have a party or something. And then they get the Yellow Pages person around to fix the scratch on the table. Now seems a good time to ask, how can I fix the scratch? Is it possible? Well, I came across this article on your website. Felt tip pens, toothpaste, yellow. I don't think the Yellow Pages actually exists anymore in the actual book form, but maybe they do. Simon. What on earth am I talking about?
Okay. In the latest episode of Toby Warne's Make, Do and Mend series, he is making your furniture as good as new. Mayonnaise, Woo! Toothpaste and an iron can all be used to remove marks. So, firstly, we've got watermarks. How do you remove watermarks? White ring marks on wooden tables, usually caused by moisture penetrating the surface's protective finish. So, Darren Eaton of NH Eaton French Polishers in Bishop Stortford says, First, take a step back. Your first task is to discover if the work furniture is waxed, lacquered, oiled, or varnished. Easy for a trained eye. You need to make sure you get it right. You can put a fingernail to wax furniture and you'll find it softer than a lacquer of French polish or varnish. Old finishes often have a duller sheen. Do not start before knowing the finish. So Darren says, I can put a cotton tea towel over the ring mark and glide a hot iron over to draw out the moisture and the mark. Other options that can banish such water stains include rubbing the area with a cotton cloth dipped in mayonnaise or toothpaste. Both of these contain a mild abrasive. And there's various other ways to fix your furniture. Your scratch. I'm not sure how you get rid of your scratch. I'm just trying to find out how you get rid of your scratch here. I can sand off stains. Scratch. I'm not so sure about scratch, what you do with scratch. That's where you require some French polishing, isn't it? I think French polishing is the way that you get rid of a scratch. What I do,
I was just going to go for felt tip pen or something like that, or some sort of.
You need to be very careful about just getting advice from your mates, particularly if your mates know nothing about it or are not very sensible, or if anybody's listening to this are teenagers or young, because I know that a friend of mine, there was a story when he was a teenager that involved people around his house. Something got left on the table. There was some kind of mark. And I believe the suggestion was that needed to put some wine on it or something. And then that obviously made it worse. And then someone said, no. What you need to do is you need to put like something on top of it that's flammable and then burn it off. Like, so then obviously that's just like made it even worse. And then they had to get in a professional furniture restorer to fix it for them at great cost because they had made it substantially worse.
If anyone has any tips for me, please, you know, a big request here. Help me out. Tell me how I can get rid of that scratch. I think it's wooden-y thing. Can't think what the colour is. Sort of moly colour. Anyway, that's it for this
week. Good luck finding a felt tip pen that colour.
I know. I can't think. What torp? Is that what they call it? What's the word? I don't know.
Torp's colour. Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. It looks about torp. That. Maybe some paint.
If you had a scratch and you got a felt tip pen and you coloured it,
looking at it now,
it might look better than it does now. The risk is it looks worse.
Yeah, I mean that's the dilemma in life generally, isn't it? It could go one way or the other, Simon. Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, or any tips for me, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. Join in the debate in reader comments.
Yeah, I wouldn't email Simon about my tips because he doesn't care. I do. So just get in.
You want to tell Georgie how to fix her furniture? Tweet Georgie. Yeah. Do that.
I don't actually look at tweets anymore or that much.
Don't you?
But crack on. Instagram.
Do you want to fix your furniture or not?
All right, I'll look at it for the next week. I'm online. Right, that's it. If you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.